Tonight, it's Dr. David Clark, his course leader and senior lecturer in journalism at Sheffield Hallam University. Prior to teaching journalism skills, he worked as a news reporter for the Sheffield Star and Yorkshire Post and spent 4 years working as a press officer in local government. His PhD in folklore was completed at the National Centre for English Cultural Tradition, University of Sheffield, in 1999. Since 2008, David's been working with the National Archives as their consultant for the ongoing release of the UFO files created by Britain's Ministry of Defence. And his book, The UFO Files, was published by the National Archives in September 2009. So David is essentially the person who appears on the news whenever there's a new release of the UFO files. It's him, and then it's Nick Pope. He's the sensible... No, don't I mean, the topic tonight isn't, in fact, UFOs.
Not for that.
As you can see, it's the Angel of Mons. I must admit, this is a topic that's got a kind of special place in my heart, because the very first radio interview I ever did, which was back in Leicester, I think I was still a PhD student at Leicester University, and I did this programme on, you know, kind of general sceptical approach to the paranormal, and they had a phone in, and I got one call, which was... Well, what about the Angel of Mons then, you so-called expert? And much to my embarrassment at that point, I'd never heard of the Angel of Mons. Since then, I have read David's excellent book on the topic, and I'm now a complete expert. But without further ado, over to you, David.
Thank you. Yeah, so it is great not to have to talk about UFOs for once. I can put that behind me. So I've just been doing an interview for a podcast, and what I was saying in that was trying to summarise what my interest is, you know, my overriding interest, and I think you'd call it modern legend, contemporary legend. That is really my bag, and this is where the Angel of Mons comes in, because it really is a classic modern legend, and I've always been fascinated by stories that are generated by the unique circumstances created by war. So it's got everything for me, this story. And the First World War in particular, the war to end all wars, as it was called at the time, is particularly rich in legends and folklore of every kind. I'm sure just about everybody will have heard of the Christmas Truce. Hands up if you haven't heard of the Christmas Truce. Some of you may have heard about the Vanishing Regiment of Gallipoli, which is another story that does the rounds on the internet to this day. You know, the regiment of soldiers kidnapped by aliens in the midst of the Gallipoli campaign. And then there is the other well-known story about the Russians with snow on their boots. Have you heard that one? Who arrived in Britain on the eve of the war to help us on the Western Front. Everybody had seen them, you know, the railway carriages with the blinds drawn that were trying to hide them from the German, the press censor. But the Angel of Mons, despite all those stories, the Angel of Mons is undoubtedly the most inspiring, the most enduring, and the most influential legend of the First World War. A few years ago, there was a BBC Radio 4 programme made on the legend. It was described there as Britain's first urban myth. And whether that is true or not, I don't know, but that's how they described it. And it's also been described as the single most influential paranormal event in British history, which was how Kevin McClure, another sceptical author, described it. I'm quite say, I won't go that far, but not far off anyway. So first of all, I need to be clear what I mean when I'm talking about legends and what I mean when I say I'm talking about myths, what they actually are, so there's no misunderstanding. And this is where my training as a scholar in folklore comes in handy, because a legend is simply a story told about a person, an object or a place that exists, existed or is believed to have existed. The legend of Robin Hood is one good example. Even when a story concerns something that's supernatural, like the Angel of the Mons, it's a story that's told as if it was true, and it's usually believed by the person telling the story and the person listening. Now, legends are the building blocks of myths. Myths are very different to legends. When people, particularly journalists, refer to myths, they usually use the word to mean that something that is, by definition, false, which is why you get people dismissing this, that and the other story as a myth. Well, that's one usage of myth, but the actual correct usage of myth is the one I'm taking from the Oxford English Dictionary, which says that a myth is a traditional narrative sometimes popularly regarded as historical but not authenticated. So a myth isn't something that is inherently false, but that's the way it's used in popular discourse. So I'm talking about myths, I'm talking about stories or beliefs usually involving supernatural beings that people turn to in order to make sense of things that they don't understand. That's what I talk about when I'm referring to myth. And examples there include the Greek myths, the Norse myths, the creation stories, the Book of Genesis, and the UFO myth. So I often get taken to task for suggesting that UFOs are modern myth. But if you look at the opinion polls that's been done, we find that up to a third of Americans and a similar number of Britons believe that extraterrestrial beings have visited the Earth at some point in the past. Now, it cannot be disputed that this belief is, to go back to the Oxford English Dictionary definition, quote, a traditional narrative popularly regarded as historical, which millions of people accept as fact, despite a conspicuous lack of proof. So it's a myth, whether they like it or not. So when I use myth in this context, I'm referring to an idea that many people believe, but for which proof is still forthcoming. Myth doesn't mean false or untrue. So I've talked about the myth in the context of UFOs and extraterrestrials, but also I want to talk about the idea of belief in angels. And there's been all kinds of surveys that have been done, and a number of people who believe in angels. A survey in 2004, for instance, found that a third of the population reckon that they believe in angels, and that 17% had actually seen one. Similar numbers of people hold beliefs about not only angels, but about the existence of the devil. For instance, a 2002 opinion poll by CNN found that almost two-thirds of Americans accept the literal truth of the end times predicted in the Book of Revelation. They believe this will result in a final battle between God and his angels and the Antichrist during their lifetime. So another example of a modern myth. Which brings me back, I'm digressing a bit, back to the First World War. Now, about 100 years ago, at the outbreak of the First World War, people were making very similar predictions. In the Allied countries, the Germans were portrayed as a godless and evil race intent on world domination. And the British press spread stories of German atrocities in Belgium, including the massacre of women and children. The use by the Germans of poison gas and the sinking of the Lusitania in 1915 only added to the belief held by many that this was the war to end all wars, the final battle described in the Book of Revelation. So people were talking about it as if it was imminent back then in 1914. And faced with such a devilish foe as the Germans, it was inevitable that God and his angels would be fighting on the right side, i.e. Britain and her empire. Which brings me to this image. This is a painting depicting the legend of the Angel of Mons that hangs in the entrance hall of the Grand Place in the little hilltop town of Mons in Belgium. So if you're ever in Mons, pop into the town hall and go into the main chamber. There's this fantastic painting by Marcel Gillis, which you can see there. And this basically illustrates, you know, what is supposed to have happened. If you go to Mons and you buy the guidebook to the town, you'll be told how angels and celestial archers descended from stormy skies one faithful day in 1914 to save the town from the German army. So rather than the modern idea of aliens coming from outer space to sort of sort all our problems out, back then it was angels who were intervening. And during the Great War, many thousands of people came to believe that this had really happened, this miracle, and saved the British army during the very first battle of the war. Now, in some versions of the legend, a vision of St. George and celestial archers had halted the Kaiser's troops, whilst others claimed that a vision of shining angels had thrown a protective curtain around the British forces, saving them from annihilation right in the nick of time. And it all sounds fantastic, unlikely, hard to believe today. And looking back, we can describe it as a modern legend. But back in the dark days of 1914, 1915, thousands, if not millions, of people across the world didn't regard it as a legend or a myth. They regarded it as absolute fact, and it was almost treasonable to question it for a period of time. Mons was not, of course, the first time that it had been claimed that supernatural intervention had occurred on the battlefield. It's a theme that can be traced back thousands of years. Indeed, this actually provides one of the first clues about the actual source of the Mons story in myth. We can see that similar stories in the Old Testament which describe how angels protected the Israelites from their persecutors. One of the best known stories concerns the Assyrian army who laid siege to the cities of Judah, demanding a huge ransom. But according to the Bible story, as they sheltered overnight, they were visited by the angel of death, who killed every valiant warrior, leader, and commander. There are many stories like this in the Bible. In a later century, divine horsemen appeared in the sky to protect Judas Maccabeus as he led his army against the much larger Roman forces. According to the story, the Bible story, the horsemen formed a protective circle around the Jews and launched arrows and thunderbolts against the Roman forces, which scattered in panic. Now, there were similar stories grew up in the Middle Ages surrounding the Archangel St. Michael, who is depicted in medieval art as an armoured warrior overcoming the forces of evil, often depicted in the form of a dragon. And from an early day, the British army encouraged the legend of St. George as the patron saint of England and protector of our soldiers. In many ways, the cult of St. George is identical to that of St. Michael. Both are depicted as dragon slayers and protectors of Christian soldiers. And it was a vision of St. George who, according to legend, folklore, appeared in the sky to save the Crusader army from the Saracens at the Battle of Antioch in 1099. So all these things are all sort of involved in this sort of myth, you know, of supernatural intervention in battle. So it becomes clear that this idea, this belief in supernatural intervention, either by angels or by St. George, was deeply implanted into the British psyche from a very early date. And it reappears at times of peril, 1914, 1940, all these sort of periods when these things resurface. What I find interesting is that here in 1914, right in the midst of a ferocious modern war, fought on an industrial scale with machine guns, aircraft, poison gas, there was a revival of ancient myths and legends that hark back to the medieval period. And one of the characteristics of myth and legend is that whenever they are spread, people actually want to participate in the story and become part of it and retell it. And folklorists refer to this phenomenon as ostension, if you hear that word. That's what it's referring to. What this means is that you will get people coming forward who claim that they have had real experiences which are based on widely circulated legends but are actually independent of them in some cases. And so it was with belief in the angels and Mons. I should mention at this point that during the First World War, the angel legend became the centre of a small cottage industry. It was actually the UFO industry of its day. And for several years, newspapers were absolutely full of stories about it. There were dozens of books, pamphlets, religious tracts that were published about the Angel of Mons. There were the believers and the sceptics, exactly as they are today. There was even an Angel of Mons waltz, as you can see here, which apparently was a bit of a dirge. Various sheet music devoted to the angel story. Even one of the very first silent movies produced in 1915, now sadly lost, was called The Angel of Mons. It's in the British Film Institute catalogue. And versions of the legend continued to crop up almost a century later in newspapers, on TV and in films. Now, who believed it at the time? Well, just about everybody. People on the home front, ordinary soldiers, generals, journalists, even some eminent historians. None other than the great A.J.P. Taylor was so impressed by what he called the evidence that he felt confident in referring to Mons in his seminal 1963 History of the First World War as, quote, the only battle where supernatural intervention was observed more or less reliably on the British side. That's A.J.P. Taylor. So where did these stories originate? Were they fact, fiction or faction, a mixture of the two? Anyone venturing into this no man's land of myth and legend risks standing on a historical minefield. But here is the story as best I can make it. It's a story that illustrates how ancient myths mixed with the imagination of human beings can become reality for thousands of people. Helped along, of course, with a little help from the mass media and the unique circumstances of war. Now, the place to start is the actual battle itself. So to understand what actually went on, if anything did, we need to have a bit of historical context. So the Battle of Mons itself. Britain declared war on Germany on the 4th of August 1914, and within days, an 80,000 strong force of infantry and cavalry, which was known as the British Expeditionary Force, or BEF, under the command of Sir John French, crossed the English Channel to support the French Fifth Army. But despite all the bravado that was going on about, you know, it'll all be over by Christmas, things were going very badly wrong right from the first day. And the Germans were way ahead of our plans. Under the Schlieffen Plan, 2 million German troops were already mobilising on the move. Thousands of troops just stormed through neutral Belgium. You see from the diagram there. Sweeping across the frontier, And the aim of the Schlieffen plan was basically to encircle and capture Paris, knocking the French army out of the war in the first few weeks. Now, the speed of that advance and the size of the German armies took the Allies by surprise, and the ill-equipped French forces took a terrible hammering and immediately fell into retreat. Cavalry was no match for machine guns. And this left the small British force that had just crossed the Channel on its own, marching north, straight into a collision course with 150,000 advancing, well-armed, heavily equipped German troops. And it should have been a massacre, but the tiny British force survived as if by a miracle, or so it seemed, on the home front at the time. Here we go. One of the few photographs taken on the day of the battle, a few surviving photographs from the Imperial War Museum. These are the troops of the 4th Battalion Royal Fusiliers assembling in the square outside the Grand Place, where the painting I showed you earlier you can see today. 23rd of August 1914 was the battle. It was the very first confrontation between the British and the Germans. The British forces were outnumbered 3-1 along a 20-mile front along the Mons-Condé Canal. For 24 hours they dug in as the German troops advanced line after line. And as losses mounted on both sides, the BEF struggled on, mowing down the advancing Germans with a hail of rifle fire. Now, this was the decisive factor. The British were professional soldiers, not conscripts. Most of them were veterans of the Boer War, and they were very well trained. They could fire 15 rounds per minute on their Lee Enfield rifles, and as their men fell, the German commanders came to believe that they were actually facing a wall of machine guns. In fact, there was only one machine gun per British regiment. The number of German dead for the battle is not known, but many thousands lost their lives. This is an artist's impression of the battle that was published in, I think it was the Illustrated London News at the time. In spite of their deadly firepower, the British were slowly overwhelmed, and there were 1,600 British troops killed before the order came to retreat. The first two Victoria Crosses of the war were won in the heat of that battle, as they sought to stop the Germans from crossing the canal bridges before they got to the town. Eventually the order came to pull back, and with the Hun in hot pursuit, there then began the famous 12-day retreat from Mons to the River Marne, where finally the Kaiser's army was halted before it could reach Paris. And it was at that point that they then began to dig trenches, and the horrible phase of trench warfare began. But en route to the Marne, the hungry and exhausted remnants of the British army marched a march without break for 200 miles through the French countryside in oppressive August weather, fighting rearguard battles with the Germans all the way. And that's where the story begins to get a little bit weird. Again, this is a photograph showing the troops retreating from Mons from the Imperial War Museum. Now, if you read some of the entries from the regimental diaries at the time, this is from the Middlesex Regiment. It records, quote, that the men stumbled along more like ghosts than living soldiers, unconscious of everything about them. Marching, they were hardly awake, halted, whether sitting or standing, they were instantly asleep. So there's some serious sleep deprivation going on here. Boiling hot, exhaustion. Many soldiers reported vivid hallucinations as exhaustion and that sleep deprivation took the toll. This is another example from the war diary of the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers during the retreat. There's a line in there that says, at one point there gleamed a bright light a mile ahead and another a mile to the rear, while the road seemed flanked on either side by a sheet of water, beyond which other troops, mounted and dismounted, appeared to glide. Another, who was mounted, recalled how he spent the night ducking his head to escape imaginary arches that spanned the road. Vivid and exaggerated accounts of the plight of the retreating British army were sent back to England by journalists embedded with the army. Here, they usually fell foul of the official press censor, who held a stranglehold on the flow of real news about what was happening on the front, because normally it was filled with all this stuff about British troops, you know, glorious victory over the Germans, all this kind of thing. This is from the Sunday Times, I think, around the time of the battle. The most influential press story was the account of the Mons battle written by Arthur Moore and published in the Sunday Times on the 30th of August 1914. Now, think about it. The battle was on the 23rd of August. It took a week for news of that battle to get back to London. Think how quickly news travels around the globe today. We've got the internet. A week before news reached people back home. Moore spoke about very great losses suffered by the BEF, which he said was, quote, a retreating broken army, and of waves of German troops so numerous that they could no more be stopped than the waves of the sea. Now, this story, apart from being totally untrue, would normally have been blocked by the official censor, bad for morale. But he was on the ball this particular day when this telegram came through, and he quickly realised its potential propaganda value on the home front, and the censor passed it for publication in its entirety, and he even added a final paragraph which read, England should realise, and should realise at once, that she must send reinforcements. We want men and we want them now. The army was short of recruits, and news of impending disaster was just the ticket. Lord Kitchener, famous poster, used it to great effect in his appeal for 100,000 new recruits, made within days of the publication of the Times story. Within 8 weeks, 750,000 young men had taken the Queen's shilling, and by the end of the year, the number was approaching 1 million. So it just shows you what this press censor can do or not do. Now, these events had two effects. Firstly, starved of news about what had really happened at Mons, people in England came to perceive that the British Expeditionary Force had escaped annihilation as a result of a miracle. That perception is important. And these headlines provided inspiration for Arthur Machen. Hands up who's heard of Arthur Machen. About a third? Interesting. Arthur Machen, a writer of occult and supernatural stories, very, very well-known, I don't know, sort of during this... Not very well known at present, but he's undergone a revival recently. He was one of the seminal sort of writers of supernatural fiction, horror fiction. And it was in his powerful position as a journalist, as he was at the time, that he began to channel his imagination into writing patriotic short stories, influenced by just those myths and legends of Britain that I was referring to earlier, the story of St. George. Like most writers, Machen was going through a broke period in the First World War, and as a last resort, he decided to offer his services to Her Majesty's Press, rather than writing books to keep the wolf from his door. And it just so happened this coincided with the period in which these events in France occurred. He joined the staff of the London Evening News, which no longer exists. I think it merged with the Standard in the 1950s. Just as war broke out, and immediately he began to produce short stories that were published alongside factual news from the front. And these included first-person accounts from actual soldiers that had been passed by the censor. In his memoirs, Machen recalled seeing the newspaper billboards announcing the retreat from Mons. And that morning he took his thoughts to church, where the story of the Bowman, which was the short story he wrote about this, the source of the legend, occurred to him. And, quote, I seem to see a furnace of torment and death and agony and terror seven times heated, and in the midst of the burning was the British army. So I saw our men with a shining about them. That's how he remembered this. And he was at Mass, he said, one day early in September, so sometime after the battle, and this idea for this story came to him. And it was published in the London Evening News on the 29th of September, 1914. What is the significance of that date? Anybody know? 29th of September?
Nicholas.
Yes. Feast day of St. Michael and all angels. Whether that was deliberate, that they kept it for publication that day, I don't know. But still interesting. Now, the mode of its appearance was striking. It was a piece of fiction with short story, clearly labelled as such, But it appeared alongside factual news, stuck reports of the Battle of Mons. And at the time, Machen himself never imagined that his words would become the source material for what has been called the first urban myth of the 20th century. Now, to summarise the story, he didn't actually rate the story at all. He thought it was, you know, unfinished, not very good. He never believed it would become what it did become. The story of the Bowman opens by setting the scene. The narrative is told through the voice of a real soldier in a style that readers recognise from first-hand accounts from the front. And the action is focused upon a stand made by a single regiment of the BEF at Mons against the relentless advance of the German infantry, which they had recently read about in the newspaper. Blown limb from limb by an artillery barrage and reduced to half their strength, the men have completely given up hope of survival as columns of German troops advance towards the trenches. Then, in the heat of the battle, one of the soldiers remembers an image of St. George that he saw on a plate in a vegetarian restaurant in London. It's not a very good story. Before they cross the English Channel. This comes to him just as he's about to be hit by the shrapnel. As the massacre draws near, in desperation, he shouts out a Latin invocation that he remembered reading on the edge of the plates. St. George, help the English. And immediately, as the story says, he feels something between a shudder and an electric shock pass through his body. The deafening roar of the battle dies away and is replaced by the sound of a multitude of voices invoking the name of the saint. Before the British lines, beyond the trenches, appears a line, a long line of ghostly figures with a shining about them. As you can see, this is this is from the Illustrated London News at the time. These are the ghosts of the English bowmen who fought for Henry V during the Hundred Years' War at Agincourt. Drawing their longbows, the medieval army let out another shout and then let loose a cloud of deadly arrows that darkened the sky above the battlefield. Then the stunned British troops see the Kaiser's army crashing to the ground, side down by the deadly arrows. Macken concludes his astonishing story with a final paragraph that reads like a news report. He says, quote, "In fact, there were 10,000 dead German soldiers left before that salient of the English army. It was not a massacre. And in Germany, a country ruled by scientific principles, the great general staff decided that the contemptible English must have used poison gas on their troops, as no wounds were discernible on the bodies of the soldiers. But the British soldiers themselves knew that St. George had brought his Agincourt bowmen to help the English." That's how he ended the story. It had huge impact. In today's world dominated by the internet and 24-hour news, Macken's story sounds old-fashioned, dated, but things were very different in 1914. Newspapers were the only source of news from the front, which often took weeks to arrive in London. We shouldn't underestimate the impact this story had on the home front, where wives and girlfriends, parents and children were waiting for news of loved ones serving on the front. What made it famous even today is the ambiguity about its reality status. This kind of writing was actually quite typical of Arthur Macken's style, the deliberate blurring of the boundary between fact and fiction. He regularly mixed journalistic first-person accounts with imaginative supernatural fiction, a heady and volatile combination in the anxious atmosphere of wartime. And the context of the tale, set in a real wartime situation and apparently told by a real soldier whose name could not be revealed because of being removed by the press censor, reinforced the impression of many readers that this was a tale built upon truth. And the deciding factor was that they were primed, ready, and wanted to believe it. And given the censorship of the news, it seemed possible to many people that only now, a month after the battle, was the truth finally being told. You know, we were being prepared, that kind of idea. So within days of the appearance of the bowman, the editor of the Evening News began to receive letters from readers asking for the identity of the soldiers who witnessed the miracle on the battlefield. Requests also came from the editors of spiritualist magazines that were very popular during the Great War. They said they wanted to republish Macken's story and asked for the authorities upon which he had drawn. And Macken wrote back to every single one of them and said, "I cannot give any authorities because I have none, the tale being pure invention." 6 months passed after Macken produced his wartime fantasy before reports of visions started to reappear in different places. And incidentally, all this began to happen again on the 23rd of April 1915, St. George's Day, when the story reappeared in churches around the country. People were using the story to sort of boost morale, because that's when things had bogged down a bit and it wasn't going to be all over by Christmas. So by that time, Macken's tale had become completely entangled with another spontaneously generating legend, the Angels of Mons. So bowmen become angels. Across the country, in churches of every denomination, Church of England, Catholic, Nonconformist, Spiritualist, priests began using the story in patriotic, uplifting sermons to keep hope alive as the war bogged down in the trenches of the Western Front. And during those bleak months, new variations of Macken's story were spread rapidly across the country. The earliest on record came from an anonymous military officer who called at the offices of the spiritualist magazine Light with a second-hand account of a battlefield vision, and he said, quote,
It took the form of a strange cloud interposed between the Germans and the British. Other wonders were heard or seen in connection with this cloud, which, it seems, had the effect of protecting the British against the overwhelming hordes of the enemy. So the bowman didn't feature in that story. It was a mysterious cloud. There was also the story of a Catholic officer. And I'm going to read this one to you and see if you spot any similarities with the actual short story of the bowman, which I've summarised. This is a story that was printed in another spiritualist magazine, and it's quoted verbatim. A party of about 30 men and an officer were cut off in a trench when the officer said to his men, "Look here, we have two choices. If we stay here, we will be caught like rats in a trap. The alternative is to make a sortie against the enemy. We haven't much of a chance, but personally I don't want to get caught here." The men all agreed with him, and with a yell of St. George for England, they dashed out into the open. The officer tells how, as they ran on, he became aware of a large company of men with bows and arrows going along with them and even leading them on against the enemy's trenches. And afterwards, when he was talking to a German prisoner, the man asked him, "Who was that officer on the great white horse who led them? For although he was such a conspicuous figure, none of them had been able to hit him. I must also add that the German dead appeared to have no wounds upon them. It was almost as if they'd been struck by invisible arrows." Fired by the bowman from Agincourt, no doubt. And just an interesting little aside here, it's probably be quite surprising to learn, I was surprised to learn this, in the first month of the war, those flimsy aircraft that were being used to patrol the battlefield, they hadn't got to the stage where they could drop bombs at that stage, and they used something known as flechettes, which were actually sharpened steel darts, and they had clusters of these, 250 of them at a time, and they would just hover over columns of advancing troops and just drop them from the air. So you can see possibly where this idea of arrows striking troops might have sort of got into the sort of the stories that were getting back to the front line. What you see from these stories, the way it was evolving, angels were not mentioned. First there was bowmen, mysterious clouds, phantom horsemen, and even ghostly reinforcements. But what all these stories had in common was that they were all second, third, fourth hand, told by a friend of a friend, classic urban legends, not told by the alleged eyewitnesses themselves. And the classic example of this is the story told by a respectable young lady, Miss Marrable. There's another illustration, 10,000 German soldiers. Miss Marrable was the classic credible witness. We hear a lot about credible witnesses. The daughter of a canon of the Roman Catholic Church, no less. She had met, according to the newspapers in England, two officers who had actually been present during the retreat from Mons, and she was widely quoted as saying, one had seen them himself. While he and his company were in retreat, they heard the German cavalry tearing after them. They saw a place where they thought a stand could be made, but before they could reach it, the German cavalry were upon them. They turned round and faced the enemy, expecting nothing but instant death, when to their wonder they saw, between them and the enemy, a whole troop of angels. The German horses turned around, terrified, and regularly stampeded. The men tugged at their bridles, whilst the poor beasts tore away in every direction from our men, giving them just enough time to save themselves. Sounds impressive. Directly from the testimony of two officers who were there when this happened. Marrable's story was enthusiastically taken up as the proof that would confound the sceptics. Thousands believed it. It was published across the world, New York Times, everywhere. Unfortunately, when journalists tracked down Miss Marrable and she was questioned, they found to their horror, and to her horror, that she'd been misquoted. And she just said she'd heard the story from somebody else and she'd got no idea who these officers actually were. She was annoyed that her name had been published as the source of the story, which she admitted she knew nothing more about than the average person on the street who'd read it in the newspaper. Amazingly, this revelation was ignored by those promoting the story of the Angels of Mons, and in subsequent reprintings of her testimony, her denial was ignored and her name removed. Pretty much like what goes on the internet today. Hoaxes added to the cauldron of rumour. The most notorious hoax of all was a legal affidavit sworn before a justice of the peace in Chester by Private Robert Cleaver, a serving soldier of the 1st Cheshire Regiment. And he said he had sworn on oath I personally was at Mons and saw the vision of angels with my own eyes. The best way to see things, I think. The men were in retreat and lying down behind tufts of grass for cover. Suddenly, the vision came between them and the German cavalry like a flash. The cavalry horses rushed in all directions, allowing the British troops to escape. He actually went to a justice of the peace. He swore a legal oath that he was there at Mons. This was published in the Daily Mail. It must be true. A legal affidavit, sworn on oath by a member of the armed forces. Does that sound familiar? Credible witness. Sounds impressive. And Cleaver's statement was seized upon as the proof, again, that would silence the doubters. Until the justice of the peace himself got a bit suspicious and thought, I'll check out this soldier. And he went to the regimental record office in Chester. And to his horror, he found that the 1st Cheshire Regiment didn't leave for France until a month after the Battle of Mons was fought. So he could not have been on the battlefield on the 23rd of August because he didn't leave England until the 30th of September. So it seems all these stories were what we might call today... urban legends, stories told by a friend of a friend that could not be traced to their source. But even when exposed as hoaxes, people continued to believe them because they confirmed what people wanted to believe. It's the only way you can think about it. Or as Macken put it, someone, unknown, has met a nurse, unnamed, who has talked to a soldier, anonymous, who has seen angels. But that is not evidence. The soldier has to be produced. So he was absolutely uncompromising. He was an original member of the Skeptical Society. But how did the Bowman, a piece of fiction, become entangled with the Angel of Mons, which was a spontaneously generating urban legend? That's what fascinates me. Well, Macken believed the link between the two versions that were in circulation in 1915 was his use of the word shining. He wrote, quote, "In the popular view, shining and benevolent supernatural beings are angels and nothing else. And so I believe the bowmen of my story, who I described as shining, have become, in the retelling, the angels of Mons." So it seems that in the retelling, subtle changes had occurred in the structure of the story. And you remember the early versions, the vision appeared following a direct invocation to St. George. St. George, help the English. That was the original story. As the story circulated and it changed and evolved, there's no invocation. The angels or the bowmen or whoever just appear in a flash at the moment, just as the British are about to be annihilated, to save them. And this, you can see, this is the idea here, the angels, you know, sort of interposing between the British and the Germans. And throughout his life, Arthur Macken continued to believe he was the author, not the historian, of the Angel of Mons. But by this time, ironically, no one would believe him. And it was ironic, given Macken's obsession with the supernatural that permeates much of his writing and his hatred of the materialism that he believed had brought the world to the brink of disaster, that this should happen to him. Originally, he appears to have encouraged belief in the story, perhaps out of a sense of patriotism, but then it took on a life of its own, you know, like a Frankenstein's monster. He couldn't stop the monster he created from his own imagination, and in the end he ended up writing a book. So he thought, well, other people are making money out of it, why shouldn't I? And this became a bestseller, about 6 editions, sold millions across the globe. The Bowman and Other Legends of the War. And in the introduction to this book, which was just a collection of his short stories, he wrote, and this is a really good passage, I really like this, he said, "It began to dawn on me that if I had failed in the art of letters, I had succeeded unwittingly in the art of deceit. The snowball of rumour that was then set rolling by my story has been rolling ever since, growing bigger and bigger till it's now swollen to monstrous size." He couldn't stop it. And as I said, ironically, despite his deeply held Christian beliefs, Macken was now portrayed as the arch debunker by believers in divine intervention. And from the summer of 1915, a whole series of books and pamphlets appeared arguing the case for the angels as fact. Chief amongst the divine interventionist brigade is this guy, Harold Begbie, a writer of detective dramas before the angels came along. He hastily published a book called On the Side of the Angels, An Answer to Arthur Macken, which again sold in its tens of thousands. In the book, Begbie claimed that soldiers had actually experienced visions on the front before Macken wrote his story. and he felt the Angels of Mons was good for morale and should be defended. And he accused Machen of jumping on the bandwagon, dishonestly claiming that he had invented the story when it was real. You know, this was a real experience. And one of his more far-out ideas was that Machen had actually been inspired to write the Bowman by a telepathic vision that he'd received from the brain of a dying soldier at Mons. Now, just think about that for a minute. If true, this vision must have been delayed by the Cosmic Sorting Office, because Machen actually wrote his story in September. If you remember, there was a delay between the actual battle happening and the news reaching the newspapers, which actually inspired Machen to write it. He didn't write it until almost the end of September. So if this vision had been projected by the dying soldier on the battlefield, where it wasn't very instantaneous, because it took a month to reach Machen. Anyway, we'll pass by that little problem. Begbie also relied upon the dubious evidence of Phyllis Campbell, a nurse who had cared for wounded and dying soldiers in field hospitals in northern France. And this is an advert for her book, Back of the Front. And she was an occultist who was driven by an intense hatred of the Germans. And in this book, only I think two copies survived, despite the fact that tens of thousands were published at the time. They've got a copy at the British Library and a copy at the Imperial War Museum. It's an horrendous book to read. It's basically, there are a few angel stories in it, but it's mixed with the most horrendous accounts of atrocities in which women and babies are being bayoneted by the Germans, rapes and mutilations that had gone on, much of which had been completely debunked by historians. Whatever happened in the Second World War, there's no evidence that this actually went on in Belgium in 1914. And yet she was claiming that she'd seen this. She'd been an eyewitness. She also claimed that dying soldiers had confided in her personally how they'd seen winged angels and giant figures on horseback leading them against the enemy. The English soldiers, according to her, identified the figures as St. George, whereas the French had seen Joan of Arc leading the men on, each interpreting the vision differently. Campbell had high connections in society and friends in the Russian royal family, who sent her stories of angels inspiring the Tsar's forces fighting on the Eastern Front. And a wag at the time said, if that was the case, it's a pity they didn't make a better job of it on the Eastern Front, because the Russians were defeated pretty straight away, not far off, in August 1914, when the Germans put up a really strong counter-offensive. But she could not provide a single name when she was challenged of a single soldier as evidence of her claims. This went on for weeks. Machen was publishing his side of the story. Begbie and Campbell were coming back in the columns of the Evening News. And he used his position as a leader writer in the Evening News to challenge Begbie and Campbell. He said he demanded that they produce the names of the soldiers who made these statements before they could be accepted as evidence. Unable to answer, Campbell claimed, and this is again so ironic, that there was a British government cover-up to hide the truth. The soldiers who had seen the angels could not be named, she claimed, because of a conspiracy by the War Office, helped by Machen, to hide the facts from the public. Those who had witnessed wonders on the battlefield were forbidden by the British Army to discuss what they had seen. In her book, Campbell promised that the evidence exists, and when the war is over and the embargo of silence is removed, Mr. Machen will be overwhelmed with corroborative evidence. Well, we're now, how many years? 95 years later and counting, and we're still yet to be overwhelmed by the evidence that Campbell said was there. Now, the idea of a government cover-up is interesting. This is one thing I wanted to mention, because it keeps resurfacing. This is a story that was published in 1930, 15 years after the battle, when several newspapers published this bizarre story that claimed the angels were actually motion picture images projected onto cloud banks by powerful magic lanterns mounted on German airplanes hovering over the British lines. Now think about that for a moment. You imagine the state of aeronautics in 1914 and the flimsy aircraft that had a hard job getting into the air and even harder job landing. The idea that these things could carry powerful magic lanterns, which would require batteries of enormous size, that they'd be able to project these images onto clouds over the battlefield. the idea, apparently, according to the story, was that the Germans had this plan that they could project these images of angels and it would create superstitious terror and panic amongst the Allied soldiers. But the plan had backfired, as all dastardly German plans do, when the British interpreted them as guardian angels protecting the troops. So it didn't work. The source for this odd claim was a former member of the Imperial German Intelligence Service. But within a day of this story publishing, as you can see here, the very next day, hoax, says German Intelligence Service. The source, according to the Germans, was either a myth or the guy who the source of the story is a liar. It's officially stated there is no such person. Again, where do these stories keep emerging from? And then there's the murky involvement of this guy, Brigadier General John Charteris, who was a very close friend and confidant of General Douglas Haig, who promoted him to the Chief Intelligence Officer at GHQ on the Western Front. Now, lots of people who've tried to make out that the Angel of Mons is fact and that the story was circulating well before Arthur Machen wrote his story on the 29th of September 1914 have referred to a passage in a diary kept by Brigadier General Charteris. His diary was published in 1931 in his memoirs, and it was supposedly a day-by-day account of his experiences on the Western Front. And there is an entry in that 1931 book dated the 5th of September 1914, supposedly a letter that he'd sent back to his wife, which reads, quote, "Then there is the story of the Angel of Mons going strong through the Second Corps, of how the Angel of the Lord on the traditional white horse and all clad in white with a flaming sword faced the advancing Germans at Mons and forbade their further progress. Men's nerves and imagination play weird pranks in these strenuous times." Now, if genuine, 5th of September 1914, written by the Chief Intelligence Officer with the British Army, if that was true, it predates the story published in the Evening News by Arthur Machen by 14 days and destroys Machen's claim that his piece of fiction was the single and only source of the legend. And Kevin McClure, if you read his online essay on this, the Bowman Myth, I think it's called, he, although a sceptic, says that this one piece of evidence undermines this argument that Machen's story about the source of the legend is the true one. Now, I always like to go back to primary sources, so although I've got a copy of the 1931 book where this entry appears, I thought, that's not good enough. I want to see the actual letter, 1914 notepaper. Now, I went online and I found that all Charteris's papers are kept by the military archives in London. So I made an appointment to go there, and you can imagine the excitement, the mounting sort of, is that letter there? And I spent a full day going through the microfilms, and it's not there. There is no letter dated the 5th of September 1914. I mean, perhaps it's been removed by the same people who've removed all the key UFO documents. But, you know, you can see the chronology of the letters and the postcards he sent home, and there is no mention of the Angel of Mons. So what's happened is, after the war, he's written up his notes from the time, and he's mixed with the contemporary diary entries, things that he remembered from that period. So obviously he heard about the Angel of Mons in the same way that everybody else did in 1915. And when he's rewritten his diary entries in his book, published in the 1930s, he's put the Angel of Mons into the story. You know, backwards fashion, into the story, and created this sort of entry, which has then been used as evidence for the Angel of Mons. So, unfortunately, that little bit of evidence, or possible evidence, just does not stand up to scrutiny. So, coming to the end of my talk now, what conclusions can we reach? You know, what can we say about the Angel of Mons legend? And at this point, I've lost my final page. No, here it is. It's a killer quote from Machen. "During the past century, many dedicated researchers have tried in vain to pursue the accounts to a final source and find a single named soldier who claimed to have fought at Mons and seen the angels. But another way of looking at it is, of the 100,000 strong British Expeditionary Force who became known as the Old Contemptibles, 90% of them did not survive the war, so they didn't tell any stories about what they experienced to anyone, because they were all killed. There were very few people left to talk about this. at the time. But I can authoritatively say that after 10 years of research, I can say with some certainty that there is not one single first-hand account of the Angel of Mons that can be traced back to 1914 itself. The Charteris letter was a false trail. It turned out to not be what it was claimed to be. Yes, there are lots of stories told by people who claimed that they were there decades later. Similar to the stories of people who claimed that they were there at the Roswell crash. You know, they cannot be trusted as reliable sources of information. And what you begin to realise is that some of the soldiers themselves actually came to believe in the Angel of Mons during the later stages of the war, particularly in the aftermath of the Somme, and were recirculating some of the stuff they'd read that Arthur Machen had published as if it was real afterwards. If anybody is familiar with Vera Brittain's book, Testament of Youth, there are stories in there that she collected from soldiers that she was treating in some of the nursing stations in France, where she describes overhearing soldiers talking about supernatural visions that they'd experienced during the slaughter on the Somme. I'll just read you one of them. One of the most striking came from a British corporal that she met in a field hospital who told her about a company of stretcher bearers who had been blown to pieces by a huge German shell. He claimed, "Last week, some of our chaps seized them again, carrying the wounded down the communication trench, and I met a chum in the train who swears he was carried out by two of them." After collecting several similar accounts of angel guardians, curiosity led Vera Brittain to ask a group of wounded soldiers if these stories were true. And she writes in Testament of Youth, "There was an awed silence in the ward, and I turned from the dressing I was doing to ask them, rather breathlessly, 'Do you really mean that in the middle of the battle you met those men again who you thought were dead?' And the reply left us stunned. It was, 'Hi sister, they're dead, right enough. They're our mates, and as was knocked out on the Somme in 16, and it's our belief that they're fighting with us still.'" So you can see there was some kind of story circulating, you know, maybe that drew upon the Angel of Mons, but also on more traditional supernatural folklore, the belief in ghosts and protective spirits. Most people who've looked at the Angel of Mons legend, and that includes the Society for Psychical Research, who did a very good, thorough investigation of it at the time, gave up in despair. And as a researcher for the Imperial War Museum concluded, "To pursue the supporting stories to source is to make a journey into a fog. You can never reach the final source, the person who saw the angel," which is a classic, what you would expect from a friend of a friend story, an urban myth. And to finish off, for his part, Arthur Machen found himself in a bizarre position. Being an enemy of materialism and a believer in Celtic mysticism and the old gods, which was the stuff he used to write about, he was forced into this position publicly, having to debunk the claims of supernatural intervention at Mons, because he set his bar for evidence pretty high, and it wasn't satisfied by what was produced at the time. And in his final years, this is a sketch that was done of him, I think just before his death in 1947, he got fed up with people asking him about the Angel of Mons. He regarded it as something and nothing. A short story he wrote he wanted to forget about, but that was the only bloody question anybody asked him about. Not about his books he wanted to talk about. This short story he wrote in 1914. And the final quote, which I'm going to end with, he was asked in 1938 when there was a multi-volume history of the Great War was published, and there was two pages in there on the Angel. And he said, "What is your final word on the subject?" And his answer was, "It was strong evidence, as I say, or rather, it would have been strong evidence, but for one circumstance. There was not one word of truth in it." Or, in the stronger phrase of Wemmick, "These stories were lies, every one of them lies." And that was his final word. In 1937, I think it was. Thank you very much.